Welcome to Self-Directed. We are your hosts, Cecilia and Jesper Conrad. And now it's time to welcome this week's guest. So today we are together with Four Arrows. And first of all, it's super nice that you wanted to take your time to talk with us. Welcome to our little time together.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show and looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah. The first natural step for me and also probably our listeners to start is, did he say Four Arrows? What do he mean? How come a man is called Four Arrows? So if we can start there, just a short explanation of why you are named Four Arrows.
Well, if I was going to introduce you in the Lakota language, I would say, Wahik petopa machi apielo, mishante tawo logalake, na na pechu de pelo. And I would be saying, my name is Four Arrows. I offer you a warm handshake and I speak from my heart. It's kind of a long story, but I'm going to try to make it as short as I can. I was a maid relative of the Oglala Lakota when I was dean of education at Oglala Lakota College. And that was after I fulfilled my four Sundance vows. A maid relative for the Lakota is making a relative is one of the seven sacred ceremonies, the Sundance, the Vision Quest, the Anipi, etc. And so I have been following that path as a maid relative. They say that my spirit will not go to the Ireland, where I'm mostly Irish, or nor to my Shilagi, or my Cherokee. It will go to where the Lakota go. So most of since I left Pine Ridge, I've continued to work on Indigenous worldview issues and place-based knowledge of Indigenous people. So I did not go by the name. I kept it as a spiritual name for many years, but I had a vision on the day that George Bush announced a war against 60 different countries during the Iraq thing, and on an omblecheye, going up on the mountain and having a vision. People said, you're right about what you believe, about how we all used to believe and live, and honor that by starting the conversations by going by your spiritual name. So I've been doing that now on my books for about 20 years. So that's what I can say about that.
Perfect. As I said before we started the recording, our podcast is called Self-Directed, and it is because we ourselves explore what it means to live a self-directed life where you take responsibility for the life created and how you are in life. For us, the whole unschooling and world schooling journey have been a big part of that. But after I read Darcy Naves' book, The Evolved Nest, and she introduced me to your work together with her, I was thinking this guy must also have lived a very self-directed life where he have taken the steps he felt was right. You use the world worldview. I have earlier worked for an NGO called Gaia Education that also have a worldview section and part of their education. But for many people, it might be not a new word, but it's a word where they're like, what are they talking about when they use the world worldview?
It's a good question because worldview is controversial. The scholarship on it now has been emerged. Robert Redfield out of the University of Chicago brought it really back into the academy in the 1930s and 40s. And his opinion was that the worldview as originally intended in a German dialogue was really to stop dialogue. It was science against science. It was science against religion, religion against religion. But he says that if we really get to the essence of what was originally intended, it's about what is our relationship with ourselves, with fellow humans, with the rest of nature, and with whatever happens to us when we leave this plane. And he says, in essence, that when you hear conversations about this, they're either about anthropocentrism or non-anthropocentrism. They are about high respect for women or low. They're about materialism or spirituality. They're about self-directed autonomy or they're about hierarchy and authoritarianism. And he says, therefore, there's essentially only two worldviews. There's the dominant Western post-colonial and colonial worldview, and there's the pre-colonial nature-based kinship worldview that we live for 99% of human history, all of us. And so I look at worldview as a dialogue opener, because for the last 9,000 years, most of us have been embracing, even if we don't like it, economics, education, entertainment, you name it, a dominant colonial worldview that is very hierarchy, very hierarchical, and not self-directed so much. But it's about, we're in this continuum. The indigenous worldview is a non-binary worldview. It's about the connection of opposites. So it's not a rigid dichotomy. So this, the worldview chart that Darcy and I have put together is based on a lot of scholarship. And it's really not about this is good and this is bad, but it's more like left and right brain hemisphere kind of work, right? Mm. So that's what the worldview is. And I make a clear distinction between indigenous worldview and indigenous place-based knowledge. Place-based knowledge, very few people have. I don't have it. It requires fluency in the language and the ceremonies, living in one place for many generations to really know how that area works, right? But all the place-based knowledge tribes that I've visited, and that's been hundreds of them, have in common what all creatures who are indigenous to planet Earth can understand is how things work, right? And so it's I think our separation from nature and the hypnosis of authoritarianism are really what has driven self-directed world. And I know my daughter, you know, really was raised with a lot of self-direction, and she has the ditch school that has. Oh, my grandson Sage graduated from UC Berkeley at age 16. He's not a genius or anything, but it was all from the self-directedness. And her ditch school has many students that are you know, ditching school, so to speak. And you might want to talk to her sometime. So that's sort of the how worldview, I think, connects to this. If you look at the 40 worldview precepts, on the right side, the everything from self hypnosis to non-authoritarianism really will show how I think naturally those of us who we remember this connection and this interconnectedness with nature, I think we tend to be self-directed.
Yeah.
I think there is a huge longing for some coming back to the original worldview, to a connectedness and the non-dualistic way of understanding or being in this world. And I'm just wondering, I think maybe a lot of people would almost give up, would think, I'm too far away from that. I don't have a place-based lifestyle. I live in a city, in an apartment. I go to work. My kids are in school. I mean, how is there any way you think would be a good, I mean, I have a lot of very radical people in my life, but there are lots of people living in a quote unquote different way. And they are closer to maybe walking barefoot and doing meditations under the full moon and trying to get back to something you might call more real. But is there something we could say to those who almost feel, yeah, that's all good and fine, but there is no path for me?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question and one I bump into very often. I don't have and this may discourage you and your audience, I don't have a lot of hope that we're going to be able to turn things around. I said that when I was at UBC talking not long ago, and I said it at the 76th General Assembly to the United Nations a few months ago. I said, I think we need to redefine hope. And this might be an example of the self-directedness. I define hope not as a certainty or an expectation that things will turn out all right. It's a certainty that whatever you're doing is the right thing to do regardless of how they turn out. If we take that idea of hope and we couple it with the idea that we are spirits in a body and that our spirits have a continuation. I mean, the work at the University of Virginia's Perceptual Studies has been called by a Nobel scientist and quantum physics, some of the best research around. I had a near-death experience, so I have personal experience with it. If we understand this, we have this sense of hope, and we look at the worldview, the foundational worldview that reconnects us to nature, then I tell people, you know, you walk down the streets of New York City and you look at the concrete and see how many weeds are growing up through that, and stop for a moment and contemplate on the wisdom and sentience and strength of that weed growing up through concrete. Look at the trees that are around and look at the pigeons and see how they're living. And find that one star in the night on the top of a roof some night, you know, that you might be able to see through the light. But practice these worldview precepts. Do ceremony. If you can get a chance to, you know, to have pets or get into nature, you know, these are starts. But realize wherever you are, then in essence, you are part of nature, and that the glass and the concrete is maybe convenient. Maybe it's has some positive and some negative qualities you can look at, but it doesn't change that as a spirit, we are part of nature and of course, then the responsibility that comes with that. So it's a great question, but that's over the 40 years I've been doing this work. It's only been in the last 7 or 8 years where people haven't had that fear that you're talking about or that frustration or that it's not for me, it's impossible. And I think that's because we've gotten to a point where nothing else is working. And things are getting so despairing, people are starting to say, maybe it is the foundation of our assumptions, our uninvestigated assumptions. And so I'm a big believer in self-hypnosis, not hetero-hypnosis. I taught hypnosis at UC Berkeley for MFCC licensure. I've written a couple of books on it. One just came out on hypnotic communication for medical emergencies. And I stopped it many years ago in Marin County, California, when I realized the dependency of paying me $300 to hypnotize someone, when really all hypnosis is self-hypnosis, can be learned easily. I had my appendix taken out with self-hypnosis. And so trance-based learning has always been a part of our ancestors' traditions, if we go back far enough. That's what ceremony is. You know, when I went into the lodge last night, the dark lodge with the drumming and the singing and the intentionality, all hypnosis is believing in an image deeply. You're in a lower brainwave frequency for an automatic response in your autonomic nervous system and otherwise for a transformative experience. And so, you know, that's one of the couple of the precepts relate to trance-based learning, to humor, it's a lot of things that you guys, especially because you're specialists in this, if you looked at the worldview chart, you go, wow, that actually relates to self-directed people. I would love to see a project, maybe we could do it together someday, but a project that looks at the people who are self-directed, how many of them are leaning into our indigenous side of that chart? You know, and I think that would be a great study for one of my doctoral students. I'll mention it in the next one.
Yeah, that's interesting. It really is.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Cecilia. We're interrupting our own podcast just to make sure that you know that I am available if you want to talk to someone who has lived the unschooling life, who has traveled the world, who has beat cancer, who has been the mother of 4 amazing children. Luckily, I still am the mother of 4 amazing children. I know about life when it's hard. I know about life when it's complicated. I know what you need is probably most of all, someone who will understand the special world that you are in as an unschooling parent. Even with your trauma and your personal history getting in the way, what I do really is to be a loving support, a rock And I do it on the base that I am a trained psychologist. I have worked with a lot of people with a lot of different situations. I am so ready to be your support, the one that you need to get some confidence and be strong in your journey as an unschooling parent. So don't hold back. I give a 20-minute conversation for free. You can talk to me on the phone or in a video call and just see if it's a match. If you want to connect, you can find me on social media or find me on my website, ceciliaconrad.com. If you're a Danish speaker, I have a Danish website, ceciliaconrad.dk, and we can find those 20 minutes and see how it goes from there. And now back to the podcast.
Yeah, I have several doctoral students now that are trying to experiment with how to use it. In fact, the Veterans for Peace has asked me last year ago, after I did a keynote there, to show them how to use the worldview chart. And now many of the chapters, and these are mostly, you know, gray hair white men, and they are starting their meetings by looking at the chart and saying, okay, we want a project we're going to choose. Are we choosing it from this perspective or from this perspective? What can we do better? But it's still up in the air because this is relatively new, is how do people use metacognitive reflection and self-hypnosis to do this? And one of the ways came to me in a near-death experience on the Rio Urique, trying to kayak down. And your readers can just go onto YouTube, and if they put in the shaman's message, arrows, parts 1, 2, and 3. You got to use all that to get it. Otherwise, a whole bunch of things on the shaman's.
We will put a link in the show notes.
We'll find the link and put it in the notes. Yeah.
But what happened is, and I won't go through the long story of the mountain lion and the Robert Murray people saving us and all that. But out of it came a vision of a cat, C-A-T, and a fawn, F-A-W-N. And those letters all of a sudden merged from where they were in the reality of deep in Copper Canyon and Mexico to neon signs in New York City, speaking of cities.
Yeah.
And I did, you know, and anyway, long story short, CAT is self-hypnosis, concentration, activated transformation. It's something that we can learn to use all the time. And then fawn are four important examples of worldview precepts that we can use to start using the hypnosis, not only to find out why we believe what we believe, why are we afraid of this? We can use regression, self-hypnosis to kind of see, Uncle Charlie, when I was 4 years old, told me that it's dangerous to be in that river. Mm-hmm. And so that's fear. Fawn is fear, authority, words, and nature. And in the indigenous worldview, those four ideas or concepts are almost 180 degrees different than the average common colonial approach to those things. So with looking at, well, what, how can I change? And then what's the issue? How does that relate to fears I have? And where do those fears come from? On whose authority am I doing this? Mm-hmm. Which is a big part of your work. Authority, words. Words are sacred vibrations. And I wrote a whole book called The Bum's Rush, The Selling of Environmental Backlash, Phrases and Fallacies of Rush Limbaugh, because he uses hypnotic language. And it was so successful, it was his book and Fox News that essentially created the idea of denying climate change, you know. So words are powerful. And then the last one is that we are a part of nature. You look in most dictionaries, the word nature says everything except humans and what they make, you know.
Okay, yeah.
Well, how does that make sense?
That far, right? And so I think the cat fawn work, and there's some, you know, I've done instructions with that. That's something people can use. And then I just had an article published in the Review of General Psychology, a 45,000-page, very peer-reviewed, about 14 revisions. But it was published and it's got a lot of hits now. on how to decolonize Western psychology. And some of these things are being brought into that. And I talk about how to use Kat Fawn in ways that really empower the if you are going to have that.
So for hours, sometimes when I'm thinking about indigenous worldview and people talking about it, also because I was the interim CEO of Gaia Education, and a lot of the people we worked with was people living in eco-villages. So I would talk myself into a question, so bear with me. So the people I saw there, they were, you can say, far out compared to people living in the city going to a daytime job. We talk about people trying to live in harmony with nature, growing their own food and all these things. And it relates a little back to what Cecilia said. What am I talking myself to is if we are to change the world, that was one of the things I saw when I sat in this position was, I believe it would be very difficult to get everybody to live in eco-villages.
Impossible.
And that was what Gaia Education was selling. It was like, here's an education on how you can create an eco-village. And I tried to turn them in a direction where I said, this is not possible. But I still believe we need the outliers, the people who are walking in the distance, showing how it can be done. But I'm sometimes lacking the work of saying, how can we draw from this and use it in everyday modern life? Because I believe that more than 90%, or I don't know the percentage, but super many people will still prefer to live in the modern world somehow. So, and how is it we can draw from this?
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, not most intentional communities fail within 10 years.
Yeah.
Now, there's a few. There's one eco village in British Columbia that is a beautiful model and has been successful. And I've worked with them, and I'm going to be working more with them. And it's amazing because it really is changing the policies of the cities around about gray water and things like this. You know, so it's really it's engaged with the others. It's not an escapism. I think that we have to look at, if there's going to be an ultimate transformation back into balance, that the extremes are not going to be representative. I'm an extreme and I'm not a representative. I'm 77 and I'm out surfing and I just got back from a 2-hour bike ride and I'm learning to juggle and I do a lot of extreme things, right? And when I ran the largest residential treatment program for troubled youth, I brought in animals for them to use. I took out all the Coke machines and I put them on Omelcap, which is placebo spelled backwards because they were all on drugs, right? And that was radical things to do. And I refused orders that I thought would hurt people and, got fired for that, right? So we're not going to be models, right?
No.
What's the average person doing? And then how do we, with worldview reflection, how do we get them to have less of a reliance on the concept of convenience? How do we move them to be more compassionate for ants and cockroaches, snakes and birds? How do we move them to begin to understand how interconnected they are? How do we move them towards starting to look at the opposites instead of anger, moving in a direction of symbiosis and complementarity? How do we look at conflict resolution, not in terms of punishment and revenge, but in terms of somehow bringing us back into community if possible? And how do we start doing that and then looking at the health and vitality of our bodies? These were always primary. I just went and got some things over at a neighbor's house and I've been visiting them for a long time, but I never said, how long have you lived here? And she gave me the story about how her husband and 10 siblings lived there, and they all lived long lives, healthy, and yeah, sure, that's kind of radical in that this is a very remote place and it's mostly wilderness. So maybe that's not a good example. But ultimately, we're going to have to find ways to balance, and technology isn't going to get us there per se. I mean, technology's always been around. The corn was an indigenous technology. Some people think it was ever, but it was always about balance. What will this do to the balance? And if we start thinking in terms of balance, we'll make the changes. We'll choose the technologies. We'll start finding different ways to get along. And then the capitalism has to be addressed. Capitalism, like anthropocentrism, is killing us. Mm-hmm. I've written a chapter, a peer-reviewed chapter in a book called Anthropocentrism is Killing Us. But I haven't written one on capitalism because a lot of others have. And the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower mentioned, you know, what's happening in Palestine. I have a lot of personal friends there and on both sides. And it's insanity.
Yeah.
And we're watching insanity on television, and people won't talk about it because then you'll be accused of anti-Semitism. But
Foyeros, how do we, what from the different indigenous worldviews could we draw from to bring balance if we should get some ideas to people?
You can't pick and choose like we do in the Bible, right?
No.
You can't do it, because worldview is all of these things. And I say that in the preface. We have to look at this. Somebody says, oh, well, I'm going to become less hierarchical in my job, in my work, and I'm going to deal with that as an employer and a manager. I'm going to be less hierarchical. But that's number one on the list. Number 40 on the list is high respect for women. All right. So let's say this guy, because of his upbringing, and everything, he's still pretty macho, pretty patriarchal, and pretty, think women are one rung under us, right? There's no way he's going to do the first one until he also changes the 40th one. There's no way he's going to be less hierarchical if he has that feeling about women, right? So it's really, it's the worldview chart itself gives you the opportunities to self-reflect on why I'm doing what I'm doing, why I'm afraid of this, why I'm not doing this. And from that, then the real life experiences come. Like my daughter's ditch school, its subheading is all about counter-hegemonic education.
Mm-hmm.
So if we don't know what hegemony is, if we don't know how the ruling elite are hypnotizing us to believe things so they don't have to hold a gun to our head, and then we're doing them voluntarily, my doctoral students are taking a course in counter-hegemony. My first thing, on the first night of the class, I say, I want everybody to tell me how all of us were taught about Helen Keller. And I bet I could ask the two of you the same question, right? How we were taught about Helen Keller a classic example of educational hegemony? Nobody more self-directed than Helen Keller in American history I can name, right? She was on J. Edgar Hoover's hit list, one of the most dangerous women in America. She stood in Carnegie Hall speaking against World War I and entry into it. She was a member of the Wobblies, the most radical labor union, to protest against that. She was a socialist, on and on and on, right? And all the things that we don't want people to do because they don't follow, if we had people that knew the truth about Helen Keller, we probably wouldn't have gone into Iraq, right? Mm-hmm. So we've got to get to the fundamental assumptions that we make about life that we're pre-colonial or post-colonial. Using indigenous is problematic because people, think that, we're talking about a group here. And I'm not talking about a group. In fact, most indigenous people have lost this. My Navajo students tell me 80% of the Navajo reservation now has totally lost this worldview and lost the ceremonies, lost the whole thing, right? And the Kogi still have it, but it's starting to get lost. The Raul Marie Cimarron are struggling, So this belongs to all of us. And until we get the worldview back, we're not going to make the changes that us radicals are making, right? And so the radicals are doing it, and yeah, sure, they can be a model, but not really, if you know what I'm saying. Yeah. Mm. And so those are really great questions, and I hope our dialogue. I'm learning as I talk, and you're learning, and I think that this is, you know, this is crucial. But my bias, of course, you know, as an educator, is the fundamental thing is our essential understanding and beliefs about our relationship to nature and supernature, essentially. You know, I mean, that's really the thing. Yeah. What do we believe, and why do we believe it? And once we get there, then we start looking at religion. Well, it's okay, it's cool for social get-togethers, but ultimately the evidence is against it. I mean, racism comes from Western Christianity. You know, I've had an African-American man named John Chenault, who's the head of racist studies at the University of Kentucky. And he did his dissertation on it, and he speaks to my students, right? But, you know, so we start to change our institutions and the corporations, you know. Yeah, it's great that some people are now making rivers persons. There's a few countries that have done that. But we're a long way from many more doing that, right? And that the idea that a corporation is a person is more ludicrous than that a river is a person.
Four arrows. Let's try to also go in personal in the way where we maybe try to explore how you and we try to create a balance in life. So can you share a little about how you, with the knowledge and the worldview you have, are balancing to get in this balance you're talking about?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, just a short interruption as I have a small message about some of the things I'm working on. My name is Jesper Conrad. It is my pleasure to invite you to become a less stressed dad. I know how it is to be stressed out. My wife, I had cancer. I have 4 kids and I had a long career and had to juggle everything at the same time. And it's hard. It's sometimes hard to be a dad. It's hard to be the breadwinner, if that's what you are. That's what I've been in our family, where my wife have been at home with our children. And it takes its toll. And one of the things that really help is to talk with someone else about it. And that is why I've created the Better Dad Institute together with my good friend Martin Cook. And at the Better Dad Institute, we have dad circles where we meet up once a week and just talk about life as a dad, because sharing actually is super, super healing in the process of being a dad. To just hear that someone else is working through the same problems that you are is very, very giving. And if you're into more like a one-on-one thing, then I would happily help you and share my experience of being a dad to 4 wonderful children and having a wonderful relationship with my wife and being a full-time travel dad, how I have juggling everything at the same time, having a career, and how I have learned to get those shoulders down to actually be very happy in my life. Of course, the stress can pop up, but then I have the techniques I've learned and which I would love to teach you. So reach out at the betterdadinstitute.com. And if you want to get directly in contact with me, then it's betterdadinstitute.com/Conrad. I look forward to hearing from you, and have fun. And now on with the podcast.
Well, you know, one of them is the fortune that we have. I don't make a lot of money, but I do have a job, right? I'm a professor. And so we're able to choose where we live to some degree. Not a lot of people can do that. And, you know, we choose to live, you know, 90 steps away from a beautiful, unpolluted beach. And we're surrounded by 5 different kinds of wildcats, and boa constrictors and crocodiles are in the pond nearby. So we even chosen that. Being my wife and I, and we've been married for 40 years. I don't know if that's something that we can say, but you're just talking about me personally. Yeah. All my profits from all my 24 books that are relative to Indigenous people. I think there's only 18 of them. Go to causes. I don't need. I know what the concept of enoughness is for money, and we live that way. So that's another factor, I guess. So the idea of helping others, the idea of not overdoing it. I failed with that. I couldn't say no, and I wound up doing too much, and I wound up with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 2008. And I managed to get back into my balance, and I had a spontaneous remission in 2019, but then I lost it again in 2022, and it came back radically, and it became stage 4 large B-cell lymphoma. So I said, well, I'm going to have to bite the bullet and go to the Western model now, which I had avoided. And I went to MD Anderson, and I used hypnosis to memorize what the chemicals would do. And instead of 8 chemo sessions, I did 3 and did a lot of exercise when I didn't feel like it. And, used the worldview, fearlessness of death, for example. And now I'm cancer-free and I'm back strong again. So I think, I don't mean to keep, so promoting the chart, but people can download it for free
we will put a link to that one also. Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. And I think it's really, there's too many different ways of living to kind of really list them and learn from somebody else. I don't think a template works because we're all different and we all have, but I think that there's different ways of manifesting the worldview precepts that everybody can learn from, because we're all unique. And so the extremes of what I do, would maybe be off-putting to somebody. Mm-hmm. I have to do all of that to be in balance. No. There's so many different ways, and art and gardening but again, all the things that are the operational experiences that would happen if you were leaning more in this right hemisphere. Now, Ian McGilchrist, I don't know if you know him, he's a very famous psychiatrist, just wrote a 2,500-page book. And I love that he did it. There's some things in it that are important about recognizing the problems that we have. But I'm so critical of it because he doesn't understand worldview at all, and all he talks about is right and left brain hemispheres. And I think he might be right that this has happened, that he says we have completely lost the right brain, and that the left brain is he's a psychiatrist, psychologist, scientist, And so there's a lot of things. I think it's a great metaphor, but I think I wrote a book called Critical Neurophilosophy and Indigenous Wisdom, where I criticize neuroscience because as fantastic as it is, it can't get deep enough. It can't get into the unconscious of the spirit world. And as a result, it says things like there's no such thing as altruistic generosity because people gave money away in a monopoly game, and it lit up a light that was the same light that lit up when you were selfish, right? So I think it's complex, but if we begin to remember who we really are, that we are spirits in a body, that we are part of nature, and that all of nature is our brother and our sister, and that if we can think about that, then going to a grocery store and buying the plastic wrapped cow that's been in a horrible confined life, it just doesn't jive. So we start finding pretty soon, once that changes, then the things that are hypnotizing us into extinction, they don't happen anymore because people are thinking in a different way. And that's how the world's gonna change, I think. Does that help a little bit?
It's amazing. It's amazing. And I think, I mean, at some points in this conversation, it could sound like we might as well almost give up. But on the other hand, what I also hear you say, and what is my personal experience, is even a little step into the acknowledgement that first and foremost, I am spirit and traveling in this body, which is nature, in this amazing, amazing thing nature really is around us. If I shift to that mindset just for 10 minutes a day, everything starts to be awesome. A little bit better.
You're giving me goosebumps with how you said it. I got them all over my arm. In fact, if I could close with just a short little flute, it would put an underline with what you just said. And what it is, it's on the Trail of Tears. It's where the Cherokee were forced out of Georgia and the Carolinas by the President Andrew Jackson. Even though the Supreme Court had found against it, saying, no, they have the right to stay there. They were at gunpoint forced, and a third of my people were you know, died, and many were, it was a horrible, you know, 1,500-mile march. But imagine this, the women, and of course, most, 78% of all our pre-contact cultures were matriarchal. And I could talk about that for a long time and why that is. But the women on this Trail of Tears would sing a lullaby to the children. If the child had lost the mother, there would be someone else. But the song did what you're saying. The song said, yeah, you know, it didn't say, yeah, this is tough. That was a given. But it said, but did you see the animals in the clouds? And did you see the clouds? They're still keeping their responsibility and giving us water. Did you see the dancing grasses in the prairie and how they're feeding the four-legged who are feeding us? And did you see the beautiful colors of the fish and how beautiful they are and how they're keeping that river clean? And did you hear the mockingbird song and how it's taught us to sing? And, you know, it went on like that, right? And I think seeing the beauty in the world in a situation as horrendous as that has a comparable thing to what you're saying about what we can do now. So when you're ready, I'll just play the melody and people can just remember and that imagine a woman singing that song.
I think we should end with that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the very long thing about matriarchy and the original cultures could be a second podcast at some point. If you're willing, that would be an interesting one.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear it now?
I would love to hear a song.
Yeah, that's a fun one, and I've learned a lot from it, you know.
But would you play a song for us? Did I understand that right? And could that be a way to end the podcast?
I can play it now if you want. And
yeah, I think that would be a wonderful, beautiful way to end the podcast for today.
All right, great. Here we go. Otukashila, Wakantaka, Namakopo, Nata Tewa, Topa, Naushimaka, Hitoa, Yanke. Takoyasa.
Thank you.
Thank you. What a wonderful way to end the podcast. Thanks a lot for you being here with us today.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you liked it, then please share it with all your friends and family. We would also love it if you gave our podcast a review. Thanks.
And if you want to support our podcast and work, then you can find us on patreon.com/theconradfamily. We will continue to travel full time. And if you want to tag along, then please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Conrad Family. And you can also read more than 100 blog posts on our website, theconrad.family. Until next time, make a wonderful day. Thank you.